Welcome back to the Public Lands Podcast. This is Hadley Nellis. I will be your featured guest reporter this week, bringing you a story about the right to roam. Today, we're talking to Ken Obunis, journalist and author of This Land is Our Land, How We Lost the Right to Roam and How to Take It Back. Hi.
Hi, Hadley. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Very well.
Thank you for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Could you give us a brief history of the right to roam and what it means?
So, the right to roam is the freedom to responsibly roam over land, whether that land is privately owned or publicly owned, like a national park. So this means that in a country like Scotland, which guarantees the right to roam, you as an access taker have the freedom to, say, swim in a pond or paddle a lake or camp or hike or birdwatch or go horseback riding or mountain bike riding. It's a guaranteed right to do so as long as you do so responsibly. Now, this goes back, you can go back to the very origins of our species, our very beginning as hunter-gatherers, where we as tribe members would have the freedom to roam over our tribe's vast territories. And this began to change with the onset of farming and individual private land ownership, when individuals began to own and manage private land for themselves. And we saw this in Britain when the aristocracy began to claim a lot of what was before known as common lands and close it off and to keep it for themselves. And a lot of modern day countries in Europe have responded to this history by passing laws or putting it into their constitution to guarantee a right to roam. So, for instance, in Scotland, in 2003, they passed a right to roam law, which provides a responsible right to roam to citizens and tourists alike.
Could you talk a little bit about why that right is important?
I think it's important for a whole bunch of reasons. I think some of the most obvious is just kind of health and well-being. Walking out in nature is good for our physical health. In fact, there was a Japanese study done a few years ago about this process known as Shinrin Yoku, and I'm probably butchering the name of that, but it essentially means a forest bath or a walk in the forest. And this study looked at Japanese businessmen who would walk out into a forest, and they came back and tested their bodies, and it showed that their physical health improved in a number of ways. For instance, the stress hormone cortisol decreased in these people who had forest baths versus people in the control study. It's good for our mental health. There was a study out of Stanford that looked at participants who walked on like a leafy green campus versus a busy Palo Alto street. And then it studied them for, just depression, anxiety. And it found that the people on the busy street were experiencing things like a morbid rumination. So these are just some very obvious things. But I think it's also important to give us the opportunity for travel. Moving into the 21st century, it's not going to be long before we start shaming people for plane riding and car riding and stuff like that. So the right to roam, it gives you the option to travel locally in a future with fewer fossil fuels. But on a more deeper level, it allows for a better connection to the earth and our local environments. And when you have people out in nature, you have people who can fall in love with their local environment and people who want to protect their local environment. And I know from my own experiences that the right to roam, it just makes you feel freer as a person. You can get out there and wander. You're not stuck to just one path or one road. You can look to the horizon and kind of choose almost any direction you want. You can have adventures. You're not hemmed in by fences and rude signs and unnecessary rules. And lastly, I think the right to roam, and I think this is very important, I think it makes us as individuals in a society feel more equal. You know, for instance, there may still be great inequalities in, say, wealth distribution or land distribution. You know, the richest, the top 100 landowners in America, they own 40 million acres. That's about 18 Yellowstone National Park. That's just 100 people. So if I can walk across my country and look at someone's, you know, 10,000 acre estate and say, hey, you know, that's someone else's land. But hey, that's also sort of my land. This creates a more evolved and a more fair understanding of private property that can go far in making us feel more equal as a society.
So in your New York Times article, "This Is Our Country, Let's Walk It," you mentioned the racism that has partially caused the erosion of our right to roam in the U.S. Can you speak a bit about how racism affected trespassing laws passed in the South?
Yeah, so to back up, in early America, since the founding of our country, up until about the Civil War in the 1860s, Americans, Euro-Americans, white Americans, they had the right to roam. They had the right to go over unenclosed land, which means no fences, and unimproved land, which means no crops. And that is a huge stretch of land across early America. And from my book, I read about all the founding fathers, and I read about their youths. And guess what? They're just all roaming over their town's private countryside. So then after the Civil War, we begin to see this right to roam system begin to break down into what we have today, which is a culture of exclusion, where we see private property signs and no trespassing signs everywhere across our countryside. And you know, there's reasons that we're not racist, and some that I'd even say were sort of reasonable. But one was racist. I don't think racist is the best word either, because it wasn't just dislike or hate for another race. It was more about power and control. You could say, I'd say it was more white supremacy. So in 1865, for instance, in the state of Louisiana, they passed a resolution that acknowledged the end of the Civil War. They acknowledged the end of slavery, but they also passed a no trespassing resolution. Why would they do that all at once? It seems very random. But when you close off access to these newly freed Black Americans to the forests for hunting or the rivers for fishing, they can no longer subsist independently, and they're forced back onto the plantation. This was a way to kind of starve these newly freed folks back into submission.
Going back to today, is there a group that private property laws disproportionately affect when talking about access to nature?
I mean, I think it disproportionately affects anyone who wants to have easy access to nature. So it affects a lot of people. We have 50 states, and all 50 states have trespassing laws, which vary in subtle ways. But in all 50 states, the landowner has the right to exclude. And that essentially means that the landowner has the right to post no trespassing signs or build fences or keep people off his or her land as he or she likes. And these vary per state. You know, in Idaho, I wrote the story for High Country News 2 summers ago. And they passed a new trespassing law, which made it was very vague and confusing. And some a local sheriff's association and local legal associations, they looked at it and said a landowner might actually legally be able to shoot someone if you're just going on the land to, say, retrieve a frisbee or something like that, just like very non-nefarious ways of getting on someone else's land. So these vary state to state, but generally speaking, the American landowner has unbelievable powers to keep people away from his or her land.
So in 2012, you trespassed across America, and you wrote about it in your book, Trespassing Across America. How would you compare hiking in Scotland, a country that does have the right to roam, to what you experienced when you followed the Keystone Pipeline in 2012?
Yeah, in some ways it was similar. You know, it was an amazing hike. I walked for 4.5 months from Alberta, Canada, down to the Gulf Coast of Texas. It was just under 2,000 miles of walking. And generally, I felt pretty carefree for the bulk of that trip, because you have to imagine being out in the Great Plains and getting on top of a little grassy hill and seeing nothing but undulating grasslands as far as the eye can see. So it wasn't as if I was walking through a lot of towns or neighborhoods or people's backyards. This was all cornfields and cow pasture, and it was glorious. However, as you might imagine, you know, I was worried about upsetting landowners. I was often looking behind my shoulder and wondering, you know, am I going to get shot today? So I did kind of have those lingering worries in the back of my mind all the time, whereas here in Scotland, where I've been living for the past couple of years, there's a kind of a culture of hiking and walking, and you actually feel encouraged to go out, whether you're living in a city, a town, a suburb, or out in rural Scotland. You know, landowners, they provide the margins of their agricultural fields to walkers. They install stiles and kissing gates, which are just little mechanisms to allow a hiker to go from one field to the next through a barbed wire fence or whatever. And I suppose mostly you're just not worried about upsetting anyone. You're not worried about getting shot at all. And as long as you're taking access considerately and responsibly, you feel fine out there. And what I mean by that is, you know, you're not walking into anyone's backyard, you're not going into anyone's home, you're not harassing livestock, you're not damaging crops, you're not taking motorized access, you're not littering. If you're not doing these things, it just feels like one of the most liberating things a human being can do. And in our age of anxiety and debt and screens and tweeting presidents, you know, a carefree walk in nature is just what we need.
If more people embarked on trips like yours, do you think changing these laws in the U.S. would become easier? In other words, is this one of those issues where protest or advocacy can take the actual form of that which right to roamers seek to achieve in terms of policy change?
Protest, maybe. I don't think we're quite ready for that now. I don't think it's a good thing to, you know, get 100 friends together and just start marching across someone's land and, you know, with signs saying, please, please open this up. That is, however, how it worked in Britain. Britain launched kind of a walkers' rights movement in the early 20th century, and they would stage these mass trespasses over aristocrats' land to kind of claim the land for their own, not to seize the land, but just to say, you know, we want access to this for recreation. You know, you can still continue owning it as you have. So that's how it worked out in Britain, but I generally don't think that's the right approach now. And this may sound odd from a trespasser such as myself, but I think it's extremely important to respect landowners, to ensure their privacy, to educate the public on good anti-littering and leave no trace ethics, to give landowners temporary powers of exclusion or permanent powers of exclusion if the public can't responsibly walk over their land, and to give them legal guarantees that say, you as a landowner, you are not going to be sued if someone trips and stubs their toe and wants to sue you. But I think maybe the most effective thing to do would be to visit a country that has a right to roam, like Scotland or the Scandinavian countries, Norway, Sweden, Finland, and experience it. And when you go out to one of these countries, it feels so liberating. In England and Scotland, you have these hiking trails, which go all over the place. They're on roads. They go through people's pastures, they go along farms, they kind of go everywhere. And when you're on one of these little paths, it just feels like this is how it should be. And you see how it's working. Landowners don't mind. In Sweden, they did this study a few years ago, and they asked rural Swedes if you object to the Swedish right to roam. And 98.5% of Swedes in the rural part of the country, and the rural part of the country is where you're most going to be affected by a policy like this. And 98.5% basically had no problem with the Swedish right to roam. And you see here in Britain that hikers are almost always really respectful, and it's just a non-controversial thing. So I think that might be an important step the United States citizens can take to educate themselves on the right to roam as both a landowner and an access taker.
Last week, I had the opportunity to interview a man named Eric Sherman, and he works for the Ice Age Trail Alliance. The Ice Age Trail is a hiking trail that goes all the way through the state of Wisconsin, and it oftentimes goes through people's private property. And one of the strategies that he and the Alliance have taken is coming up with land easements with property owners. Do you think that is a good middle ground between denying access and having the right to roam?
I mean, anything that can be done to promote more access to nature, more walking, is good. And I'm not going to object to that in any way. But do I think that's an incomplete way about giving more people the opportunity for experiences in nature? Yeah, I do think that's an incomplete way, and it's a very difficult way, because we essentially have 1.5 billion acres of land that's private in America. If you look at the lower 48 states, excluding Hawaii and Alaska, 75% of the American landmass is privately owned. So to kind of expect to make agreements with these millions of American landowners for easements and whatnot, I mean, it's just not going to happen.
Has there been any recent legal progress on restoring the right to roam in America? And how invested do you think Americans are in this issue?
Legal progress? No. Sometimes I feel quite alone in advocating for this. You know, there was an interesting development in the Canadian province of British Columbia. They were actually talking about a right to roam bill for their province, and that may be a sign of things to come. That's the first time a Canadian province or American state has ever talked about what has been restricted to Europe for the past 100 years or so. And you know what? I generally don't think Americans are all that interested in this. We're not a walking culture. We're not even really much of a hunting or a fishing country at all. And I really don't think the greater public is going to take any interest in the right to roam until we start walking more and until we start itching for more places to go. I think there's signs or indications that things might change in the near future. You know, the populations in rural America are decreasing, urban populations are increasing, and when American land is held by fewer and fewer people, the urban public might begin to demand access to that land. And this is exactly what happened in Britain, when you have a whole bunch of people clustered in cities and working in factories and just wanting some access to the beautiful landscapes outside of the city. That's when they began to really advocate for access. And you know, I think there's signs that we're moving back to being a country that values the common good over individual pursuits. You know, we're increasingly suspicious of neoliberal Reagan era economics, which can vastly increase the wealth and power of the few over the many. And I think the popularity of Democratic nominees like Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, they suggest that there's a lot of people who are deeply suspicious of this system and that they want a system that's more fair and just and equal. And you know, it's no surprise that the right to roam exists mainly in European socialist countries that value things like the common good. But at the same time, I don't want to make this sound only like a socialist enterprise, because I think the right to roam can be a patriotic thing in which we take pride in our country's lands and waters and sceneries. It can be a conservative thing in that we want to return to old values and conserve resources and sceneries. It can be a religious thing, since it allows us to commune with, as some might say, God's creation. But really, I think it's a human thing, a system that can improve our lives physically, mentally, civically, and existentially.
What might returning the right to roam to America look like?
So I think returning the right to roam to America, it's going to look like we're going to start to pull down unnecessary no trespassing signs. We're going to install stiles and kissing gates around our fences to promote easy access. It's going to be fewer pedestrian deaths on roadsides. It's going to be giving landowners the strongest legal protections they can get so they can't get sued. It's going to be education campaigns to get the public to know how to use nature. You know, no littering, no invasions of privacy, leave no trace ethics. It's going to be an extra 1.5 billion acres for countryside recreation. That's 600 million acres of grassland pasture. It's 400 million acres of croplands. It's 450 million acres of privately owned forests. Thousands of miles of rivers, lakes, and shorelines to walk. It's going to alleviate the high pressure our national parks are experiencing. It's going to be a healthier, more fulfilled, and more free people with a closer relationship with their natural environments.
What other countries support the right to roam?
So I think we can classify the right to roam under kind of three systems. One's a generous right to roam, the other's a partial right to roam, and the other's more of a restricted right to roam. So among the countries that I'd say are generous is Scotland, Sweden, Norway, Finland, and then the Baltic countries of Lithuania, Estonia, and Latvia. And these systems, these countries allow for very generous access. So you can hike, camp, birdwatch on public land or private land. You can camp at night. In some countries, you could even have bonfires. And you can do that day or night. There's partial systems, though. Countries like England and Wales, Germany, Denmark, Iceland, and a whole bunch of other countries in Central Europe, where you can do a lot of those things. You can, you know, roam over certain areas of land. In England, you have the freedom to go over mountains, moors, heaths, and downs, and coastlines, but agricultural areas, forest areas, those are closed off, and you can only do that for hiking and picnicking purposes. You can't be camping overnight. So much of Europe is either a generous right to roam system or a partial system. And then you have America, which kind of represents more of a restricted system in which private landowners have very strong rights to exclude.
How can our listeners find out more about this issue and advocate for their right to roam?
I don't want to peddle my wares too much, like some salesman, but I think maybe the best resource is my book, This Land is Our Land. When I started researching for my book, I was looking for any other literature about access rights and stuff like that, and there was nothing. So in my book, I talk about the whole history of private property in America. I look at other right-to-roam countries. I look at the right-to-roam from our hunter-gatherer days up until today, and I try to do a little moral philosophizing. I'd recommend that.
Thank you so much for taking time to let me interview you.
Oh, of course. No, I'm so thrilled to be able to talk about these issues, which I'm clearly very passionate about. And I hope I don't sound too zealous over the radio, but who knows? Who cares?
That's it for this week's podcast. Be sure to tune in next week and check out This Land Is Our Land, How We Lost the Right to Roam and How to Take It Back. Meanwhile, we hope that you get out and enjoy a public park, lake, stream, or trail near you.